is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehias Wuhib in Washington. Here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
The number of new infections, the number of hospital admissions, and the deaths that continue to take place have become far higher than it has ever been since the first case was recorded in our country in March of 2020.
That was South African President Cyril Ramaphosa on the decision to close the country's land borders due to the spike in COVID-19 cases. Details coming up also. Two cabinet ministers in Malawi died today from COVID-19. These stories and lots more ahead on African News Tonight. But first, we start with our top story. 2 days before its presidential election, Uganda has ordered social media and messaging applications to close down after Facebook deleted pro-government accounts for allegedly trying to manipulate public debate ahead of the vote. Facebook said Monday the accounts were linked to the Ministry of Information and Technology. The shutdown affected at least Facebook, WhatsApp, and Twitter. President Yoweri Museveni seeks a sixth term against a field of candidates led by pop star turned politician Bobby Wine, who has managed to fire up a youthful population that has mostly known only one president. Wine, who has spent most of the campaign in a bulletproof vest and combat helmet, facing tear gas, bullets, and numerous arrests, urged his supporters today to protect the election from being rigged. He said troops barged in as he was being interviewed live by a Kenyan radio station, saying they were beating his security guards. At least 50 people have been killed during the bloody election campaign. There are 11 candidates running for president in Uganda's January election, but just one, Nancy Kalembe, is a woman. Kalembe says Uganda needs a change of leadership after 34 years of President Yoweri Museveni, and she believes she's the right woman for the job. Halima Tumani reports from Mayugi.
Ugandan presidential candidate Nancy Kalembe is the only woman to take on 10 men in this year's election. Kalembe says the country's healthcare, education, infrastructure, and jobs are sorely lacking. She blames President Yoweri Museveni, who has been in power since 1986, and says he is behaving like the dictators he once helped topple.
He said his first act of kindness and love for this country was to go to the bush and fight for our freedom, the Ugandans. At the time I was 6 years old, in 86, my opinion would have been that the next best act of kindness is to hand over power peacefully.
But Museveni has a great deal of support in Uganda, even in Busoga region, where Kalembe is from. She's appealing to those who have not seen their lives improve under Museveni's rule. A 2017 survey of Ugandan households showed 75% of Busoga's people are poor, compared to a 63% national average. Mutesi Aida likes Kalembe's appeal. She says, "We are widows taking care of children single-handedly. Our children go to school," she says, "but we are not able to do more to better their future. So I appeal to all women in Uganda. This is our moment," she says. "We have a female speaker. Let the president be a woman." Uganda in 1994 became the first African country to have a female vice president, and Kalembe is the fourth woman to try for Uganda's highest office. But a 2016 Research World International poll showed 53% of respondents said Uganda was safer in the hands of a male president. Analysts say it will take time for Ugandans to accept the possibility of a woman president. Perry Aritua is executive director of Women's Democracy Network Uganda.
Regardless of whether it's a man or woman who gets elected, the important thing for the voter should be how they perform. Are they able to transform the lives of the people whom they have been elected to represent using the mandate they have?
While no woman candidate has ever come close to becoming Uganda's president, Kalembe hopes her campaign will at least keep alive the idea of a real change in leadership. Halima Athmani for VA News, Mayuge, Uganda.
Two cabinet ministers in Malawi President Lazarus Chakwera's administration died today from COVID-19, which is spreading among top government officials. Chakwera is addressing the country on the growing crisis, which includes a two-week suspension of the headquarters for the Immigration Office and Blantyre. Malawi is registering an unprecedented rise in cases and deaths in the second wave of the pandemic. South Africa has closed all its land borders to try to curb the spread of COVID-19. The announcement by President Cyril Ramaphosa comes as the pandemic's second wave has seen the country's infection figures rapidly rising to alarming levels. Some economic sectors also remain restricted, leaving the business community worried. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
In a national address, Ramaphosa said the pandemic was at its most devastating levels.
The number of new infections, the number of hospital admissions, and the deaths that continue to take place have become far higher than it has ever been since the first case was recorded in our country in March of 2020.
Analysts say there is no doubt that the recent congestion at almost all of South Africa's major land borders prompted the government to shut them down. A humanitarian crisis was declared at the Bedford border post when crowds of Zimbabweans desperately trying to cross the border camped there for days. Ongama Mtimga is a political analyst.
A lot is at stake when we are seen to have loose controls of our borders. What I like, though, is the fact that the president did allow permanent residents as well as South African citizens to be able to return.
Ramaphosa also extended the ban on alcohol sales and distribution, saying evidence shows it has significantly reduced the number of trauma cases taking up hospital beds. But Sandile Zung, president of the Black Business Council, says the alcohol ban will have a devastating impact on the economy.
The hospitality sector is suffering. The beverage sector is suffering. The food sector is suffering. I mean, the impact on employment and entrepreneurial success is quite severe.
The continued closure of recreational areas has also come under fire. Chifiwa Chivengwa is the CEO of the Tourism Business Council of South Africa.
We are disappointed that the beaches continues to be closed, whereas the president talks about people should not be gathering indoors. Beaches are outdoor, there is open space. It is a place whereby people should be able to enjoy that type of space. This goes with parks and many other activities that are closed, including rivers. We are disappointed about that. It is an important aspect of tourism.
Since the beginning of the year, South Africa has recorded nearly 190,000 new coronavirus infections and around 5,000 deaths. A total of 1.2 million infections have been recorded to date. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
As Tunisia marks a decade since the historic popular movement, the anniversary is bittersweet for many citizens who say little has changed. Despite elections and a slew of political promises, many denounce the country's political elite. Tunisians had high hopes when they toppled the Ben Ali regime 10 years ago. But has Tunisia's uprising delivered on its promises? VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Chenawi spoke to Radwan Masamoudi, president of the Center for the Study of Islam and Democracy in Tunisia, about what was achieved and what is lacking.
Tunisian revolution succeeded, in my opinion, in the political sphere by establishing the first real democracy in the Arab world. This is actually quite an achievement. It's not easy, especially when we compare it with the other Arab countries, which also had revolutions at the same time, but have failed in their democratic transitions. However, the Tunisian revolution has failed in the economic and social spheres because we have not seen significant improvements in the economic and the social environment and situation in Tunisia yet.
I mean, Tunisians' transition to democracy, corruption has been a destabilizing force infecting all levels of its security, economy, and political system. How did corruption contribute to the lack of progress in post-revolution Tunisia?
Corruption has been a huge problem for many years, even before the revolution, and was one of the main reasons we had a revolution in 2011. After the revolution, we had a phenomena which is called democratization of corruption, which basically means that during the first years of the transition, corruption becomes even more widely spread because the government becomes weak and does not have all the means to control corruption in the initial years of the transition. This happens in every country which goes through a transition to democracy. However, in the last few years, I think we are starting to see stronger and stronger laws to control corruption, and we are hoping that in the next few years, we will see corruption come under tight control and under the grip of the government.
While Tunisia may have been the birthplace of regional movements for change, few reforms have succeeded in getting the transition on track. Why?
Well, one of the main problems has been the lack of political stability, which means that we've had almost 10 governments in as many years, almost one government per year. And this lack of continuity and lack of political stability has not allowed the implementation of the reforms that are needed to strengthen and improve the economy or to strengthen and improve the social environment in Tunisia. There has been a high turnover of governments. We have chosen a parliamentarian system since the revolution to prevent dictatorship from coming back under a presidential system. But a parliamentarian system also gives us a weak government because we don't have strong political parties yet in Tunisia after the revolution, and we have a lot of smaller political parties, and we need a coalition of several political parties to form a government. And this makes the government unstable because it is at the mercy of those smaller political parties and coalitions.
The IMF said that Tunisian public and external debt were expected to reach 89 and 110% of the GDP, respectively. What is needed to avoid an economic collapse of the only success story of the Arab Spring?
First of all, it is important to remember that even though the economy has not been doing too well for the past several years, it has worsened significantly in 2020 due to the COVID-19 pandemic. The pandemic has really slowed down the economic activities and has increased unemployment, has reduced investment, and so on. So we are hoping that when the pandemic will be over, hopefully soon, that we will see renewed economic activities and renewed economic interest. The other thing is people now are calling for about how to jumpstart the economy in order to build a common vision or a common agreement between all the political parties, at least the major political parties and the labor unions, so that they all agree on the reforms that are needed, including to reduce number of strikes and finding a social cohesion in the country and to have a common vision for economic growth. And we're hoping that this economic dialogue will start soon in the next maybe a couple of weeks, 2 to 3 weeks, and will lead to
That was Radwan Masmoudi, president of the Center for the Study of Islam and Democracy in Tunisia, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shenawi. Up to 25 people are feared dead after a boat sank on the Congo River yesterday. The French news agency AFP quoted officials in the Democratic Republic of Congo's northeastern province of Chopo as saying 237 people survived and 19 were still missing. Already, arrests have been made as the public prosecutor has opened an inquiry. Overloading and the poor state of the vessel is being blamed. Rivers and waterways are widely used for travel in the DRC in the absence of paved roads and railways. But many boats are old and poorly maintained, and the captains often turn a blind eye to rules on loading and safety, despite directives passed in 2019 for all passengers to wear safety jackets. The United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization says climate change coupled with population growth will threaten world food security over the coming decades. In Africa alone, the population is expected to double by 2050. That's why experts say that cutting-edge agricultural technology and satellite data must be made available to African farmers as little or no cost, and in a form that is simple for non-specialists to use. To find out more about what is being done in the area, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with André Leperrier, Executive Director of the Global Open Data for Agriculture and Nutrition, or GODAN. He began by discussing one of the challenges to be overcome.
One of the challenges with the knowledge generators is that oftentimes both the volume as well as the technical level of what they generate is a bit too remote from farmers' day-to-day reality. So part of our challenge is to work with both parties to identify the most relevant elements in a way that suddenly resonates with the farmers, that makes sense to them, and that is easy to use. Farmers don't need big data, but they need the fruits of big data to identify these pests that are harming their crops or their infestations that are also impeding what they're doing in farming.
How dependent on access to high technology or even computers is this transmission?
That's a very good question. In many emerging countries right now, I'm thinking of places like South Africa or Ethiopia, where you have these young startups that provide the benefits of precision agriculture to regular farmers and farmers associations. They provide maps of their farms or their regions indicating which part is infested or which part is too dry or which part needs fertilizers.
Part of the ethos of this fascinates me also, the idea that it's open. I mean, so much of the inequality between subsistence farmers and corporate or agricultural businesses is that they own all these satellites and have all this incredible information that is then not usually available to people on the ground who need it.
That's very true, because it's one thing to say that, oh yeah, sure, satellite imagery is free and it's available, but not everybody can use it really, because it's technically not so easy. That's why we have these intermediaries, all these often young, passionate people that are developing all kinds of open source tools to make it easily understandable and usable. Private companies, they make money. That's their reason for existing. So when they invest in research, they want to make sure that they recoup their investment. However, the overall source of a lot of the data that makes a big difference in areas such as precision agriculture, precision irrigation, and so on, is free. Where there are restrictions is oftentimes in the applications that companies might have developed or using it, but it does not prevent others from using the same source as well.
Do you have any models for ways that can accommodate both the concerns of the small farmers and the large corporations that own these satellites and this data?
I could think of one that I can share with you, which I think is reasonable. Some people may feel otherwise, but a company, which I will maybe not name now, has developed applications using smartphones with a very high level of precision to identify pests, be it insects or diseases. So if I'm in the middle of my cornfield and I see suddenly all these strange insects that are killing my maize and that I've never seen before and nobody in my neighborhood has seen them before, With this app, just with the click of a thumb, you take a picture, and then within seconds, it goes to the headquarters of that company. And then using big data, it compares it to millions of other records until it finds the perfect match. And then within seconds, it comes back to you and it tells you, this insect is this, what it does is that, and the best way to get rid of it is this. And then they will say, and by the way, we sell products that can also do the trick. So that's how they recoup their investment. But what is nice is that you don't need to buy their product. Now that you know who your enemy is, so to speak, you might find some other traditional, organic, or some other means to get rid of it, because at least you have identified your problem. So you see, it's bringing big data, image recognition, which are very technical, in the hands of regular farmers in a very simple way that's very user-friendly. And yet, it still allows the company to recoup the investment they did in keeping the system running.
André Laperrier is executive director of Godan, an organization dedicated to open data sharing for the world's small farmers. He spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. Kenya's multi-million dollar horticulture industry continues to face reduced market demand and high cost of air freight due to the spread of COVID-19 pandemic and the impact of Britain's exit from the European Union. Industry players say despite the challenges caused by the global pandemic, the sector performed fairly well in 2020, but a huge proportion of export earnings went to paying air freight. From Nairobi, VOA's Ruben Chama reports.
Speaking to reporters in Nairobi, industry officials said exports faced reduced market demand due to lockdowns, especially within the European Union and the United Kingdom. Osea Machuki is Chief Executive Officer of Fresh Produce Exporters Association of Kenya.
We hope that at some point a solution to COVID-19 will be found so that people can go back to businesses as usual.
Britain, the Netherlands, Germany and France account for a bulk of Kenya's horticultural exports. About 95% of flowers grown locally are shipped out of the country, but only 4% of the fruits and vegetables are exported, with the rest consumed locally. Masi Waruguru is a fruit and vegetable trader who depends on the domestic market.
When COVID happened, schools closed suddenly with almost 100% of the money that we had supplied them, considering the credit period that we had. Hospitals on the other end started having restrictions in terms of buying, so our business went down. If you talk about hotels and restaurants, they closed down. Still, to date, they have not yet been able to clear their debts.
The East African nation earned 151 billion shillings, around $1.4 billion, from horticulture exports last year, a 5% increase from 2019. Machuki gave more details.
However, it's important to note that whereas these earnings look better than the ones for 2019, a huge proportion of these earnings actually went to logistics, especially air freight, which means that the exporters did not actually realize the profits they would have expected as a result of their trading business.
Waruguru says COVID-19 has seriously disrupted the industry.
Currently, we are doing about 10 to 20% of the initial orders that we used to handle. That has affected greatly our business. That meant almost 80% of our staff, we had to send them home. The other effect it had is that we had contracted farmers. We had to stop buying produce from them. That means that the produce that they harvested, we could not be able to absorb since our orders were very low.
However, the Kenyan trader says she remains optimistic that this year will be a good one.
Looking at 2021, the schools have resumed. So we are hoping slowly by slowly the orders will move from 20% to about 50%. It may not go back to the 100%. Considering that the vaccine is coming on board, business may resume but may not be back to normal. It may take some time. But we are hopeful that this will be a better year.
The horticulture industry is Kenya's third largest source of foreign exchange after tea and tourism. It provides direct employment opportunities to some 350,000 people, supporting over 6 million livelihoods. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiji Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Abaro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.